Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, I wanted to, we haven't talked about this, but we got to talk about this, man. Michael Gableman.
Oh.
Robin Voss. Donald Trump threatens Robin Voss. You better get that and keep that thing going. And Robin Voss, who has been wanting to shut it down, keeps it going. We're watching all of this stuff happen. And we're talking about free government. Help me understand, Sandy.
Well, what's
going on?
What struck me is in the last 15 years or so, all of what is going on, and particularly the Republican side, happens in open, plain, and it's open and notorious conduct. It's shameful conduct that is done shamelessly. You know, the idea of gerrymandering, which used to be talked about in whispers and would be denied by all those who were otherwise doing it, is now just openly discussed as a strategy. And this whole concept of keeping alive the notion that there was a giant fraud and a theft of this election, which everyone knows to be totally fallacious, is openly and notoriously talked about as a strategy that Trump is pursuing, that Trump is requiring as a litmus for anyone that he deems loyal to him. All of this, it's like we're watching the Mafia Don, you know, have his ring kissed by all of the people who want to have their bones made with the Don. It's incredible to me. And the fact is that the public...
It's in the open.
Well, it seems like... I think the public has gotten so used to this House of Cards on TV and all this stuff. This is just another kind of reality TV show that people find amusing and discount the importance of it. It's just another form of essentially political entertainment that doesn't seem to affect how they want to hold accountable their politicians. So, you know... God bless him, as some mothers used to say. You know, God bless Donald Trump. He can just do this out in the open. It's like what he said during his original campaign when he said, "I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and no one would care." You know what? He could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and no one would care.
He really could. But what gets me about this, Sandy, is the damage that it does to people's belief in our government.
Right.
How can I hear people talk about crime and people, you know, little people committing crime, and I see, you know, Robin Voss say, "Well, we're basically done with this. You know, it's not going anywhere." And then all of a sudden he gets a call from a citizen.
Yeah.
Because that's who Donald Trump is.
Well, I mean, you know, the fact is that the public has become so cynical about government that I think what's going on publicly, this cynical, ridiculous behavior, which is contrary to good sense, suggests that there's no purpose behind it other than politics. And the public has become so accepting of that that they allow it to happen openly and notoriously. So the state of Wisconsin has expended $680,000 or more on the Gableman investigation, all of it, I think, going most of it in Gableman's pocket. And he's had nothing to report. I mean, whatever he's reported is not in anyone's memory or knowledge as to what kind of findings he's made that would suggest that it ought to continue. In fact, the findings that he must have reported to Robin Voss were so scant that Voss was saying, "Well, I think it's time to end this thing." So, no, Donald Trump has said, "No, it's very important to me politically that I can run around and say that there are still 16 states or whatever the number is who are actively investigating the giant fraud of this." And so he needs Gableman to be still investigating so he can at least be accurate as to how many states are, air quotes, investigating the fraud.
But maybe they don't understand, or more than anything else, they don't care about what we think about this, because I'm watching this and other people are watching this. And the Republicans don't have the courage to say, nobody had the courage to tell Robin Voss, hey, Robin, don't do this. Everybody's watching. Robin doesn't have the courage, you know, as you stated, to say, no, do you know what this is going to look like if I go turn around and do? No, he just responds.
Well, because I think politically they found out that it all doesn't matter. All of this open and notorious conduct, which is shameful, doesn't have a negative effect in politics. And yet, and however, crossing Donald Trump appears to have a negative effect for these people, at least the negative effect they aren't willing to suffer, even if it's in a small interest group.
So what does it say then, Sandy, to those of us who continue to see this and know the crookedness of it, and you can attribute it to one party, even though you continue to hear Republicans say, well, you know, this is the way we see things, and Democrats are no different. They're no better.
Well, I mean, 84% of Republicans that were polled
disagree with that.
Well, no, 84% think that the election was stolen. 84% agree that there was significant fraud in the election. I believe that's the number. And so, you know, it, like Donald Trump said, he, you know, this guy learned how to sell snake oil some other time in his life, and understands from the Barnum and Bailey days that if you say something often enough, people will give it credibility. So he and others in politics have said often enough that there was a massive fraud that skewed the election in the favor of Biden. I'm able to repeat what they say, and there's lots of people who say, well, you know, there's so much smoke about this, there's got to be fire.
So it doesn't mean that the people who have been taken in by this are crooked. It's just that they really don't know what really took place, and so because this is their guy, and we're Republicans, we automatically just go along with it.
Well, the word fraud it ends up being a vague word. And so what people have in their mind as a fraud is different than what maybe a lawyer or a judge would think was a fraud. So, you know, the notion that mail-in ballots were made too available to too many people and it was too easy to vote, so that many people voted who would not otherwise have voted, can be a fraud in somebody's mind, even though everyone who voted was a legitimate voter. But it was we made it too easy for people to vote. And when we make it too easy to vote, a lot of people who I don't think should vote, I, the judgment maker at this point, I don't think should vote, voted. And to me, that's a fraud. Now, it's not a fraud, but it certainly had an unacceptable outcome for people who don't accept the outcome of so many people voting Democrat in an election. You know, the number of Democratic voters went way up from 2016 to 2020. You know, the number of total voters went way up. And so for people who prefer that there not be so many voters, they think that maybe it's somehow fraudulent to make it so easy to vote.
So, Sandy, let me tell you, law is your profession. Let me tell you how I and many others see all of this. We know that Donald Trump has gotten away with a lot of things that should be illegal. Many of us, from our position of laymen, think should be, he should pay a price for it. It's out there in the open. And all of this time, we keep seeing people not able to tie him into things that other people are tied into for, you know, even on less issues. And he's still there, having done many of the things that he has been accused of, but yet he's still there. We know that things have not been right, but yet they can't seem to stick anything to him. How then can we be expected to believe in the law when we see the law being manipulated by a guy and money and all those things? What happens to the American people when they see that?
First of all, to be charged and convicted of something criminally, happily in America, it's relatively hard. You know, they need to have really good evidence, and particularly if it's expected that you will have all the attorneys you need to defend.
Yeah, well, poor people,
it's a lot easier.
Yeah, that's
Because they don't have the same kind of defense capability.
So then are you saying that, and presumptions justice work, is for those who can afford it?
Well, in a way, that's true. I mean, happily in America, there is justice available. It's probably more available here than it is in many countries, but it's still not fair.
That's why I love you, because you're honest.
We don't have a totally fair system, so that clearly the wealthy have greater access to the defenses that might make it more difficult to charge and convict them. Plus the fact, most of the things that Trump has been charged with, at least so far, has been accused of, relate not to things that are very easy to get evidence of, right? I mean, did he make a promise that he then received money for?
Right.
You know, the kinds of things that the governors of Illinois and other places have been charged and convicted of had very clear criminal conduct that involved the passage of money from one to another with a promise made and all the rest of it. The kind of stuff that Trump is charged with, like, for instance, trying to impact the election through a phone call with the Secretary of State in Georgia. You know, we know about that because we've heard the phone call. And so we have to reach a judgment as to whether exactly what was intended by the words said. And the fact that while we can reach a pretty clear opinion in our own mind, it is subject to people's opinion, make it harder to actually believe you could convict someone of
that. Hold that thought. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is in the studio. It's Friday. Hey, Sandy, let me switch over to we haven't talked about stocks in a while. But, you know, stocks falling on Wall Street and sinking indexes and all those kinds of things. The folk who, you know, are involved in those things, how are they looking at that? I mean, things have been going so well. I mean, we are still looking at the Dow Jones, what, 36,000? So help me figure this out. You know, the average Joe who knows nothing about these things. When George, who is it, the son, Herbert Walker Bush or George?
I just call him George II.
George II. When George II left, the Dow Jones, and let's put this in perspective for me. The Dow Jones was at about 7,500. And now, how many years later?
It's gone up about 500%.
Probably never. That's never been seen probably before.
Well, we've very rarely, if ever, I'm not sure we've ever had a growth period, an expansion period that lasted as long. And many of the things that were happening in public policy were enhancing the ability of those of assets to grow in value. I mean, the low interest rate in particular made future earnings seem more valuable, and therefore assets which relied for their value on future earnings became much more valuable. So when prevailing interest rates fell from 8% to nothing, that had an immediate and very substantial impact on the value attributed to future earnings, and that's the way you value stock. Okay, so there were a bunch of things that came together to make the growth and the value of stock substantial. Furthermore, there was all this money held in dollars that needed to be invested, and with interest rates on treasury and on treasuries down to zero, you know, you weren't going to put your money into totally safe treasury instruments, you would get no return for it. So your money would sit and earn nothing. Whereas if you turned around and put it in stock, you know, earning nothing was almost a worst case in a situation, certainly since 2008, when the country was on an incline coming out of a serious, almost depression. So money flew out of fixed earnings kinds of stuff and into the stock market. And incidentally, that's turning around now as the Treasury instruments begin to earn interest. There's money that's now moving from the stock market back into earning real return. Real return is when the interest is greater than the inflation rate. And for several months now, it's appeared that, and recently, Treasury instruments have begun to offer real interest earnings that are enough to lure people's money out of this risky stock market, which is, you know, now very lofty, a little more risky when there's so much air under you rather than above you in terms of the value. So, yeah.
So I remember having a conversation with you some 2 years or so ago when the Dow Jones was at about 18,000, and you thought then that maybe it was a little shaky. And
yeah, now here we are at twice that high.
Are you kind of...
So don't listen to Sandy. Sandy cost you a lot of money.
And now you're looking, Sandy, and you watch, we've got, you know, 7,000 or more billionaires, all these new billionaires that came into existence since that Dow Jones was down at 7,000 and whatever it was. I guess the question I want to ask you is... And you were thinking too at some point in time that the stock market was inflated. If it was inflated then at 18,000, what is it now?
Well, I mean, I scratch my head at the intellectual capacity of the people who make investments, because the value of a stock is based on the value of the future earnings you can project from it coming back to the investor. Okay, because otherwise a document is worth nothing. Now, so it's worth that to you and to someone who would buy it from you. And the stock market is basically valued based on what someone will buy it from you for, but they're supposed to value it based on this future income stream concept, right? It's like buying an apartment house. An apartment house is only worth the rents that you will get from it. Well, stocks are the same kind of thing, except they're paper, and what will be the income you'll earn from it. And if the interest rates are high, then the value of the money that you will earn in the future goes down, because you need to get rewarded for the fact that the dollars you get paid off with are worth less. You know, every year of inflation deflates the value of the dollar in those future years. And so the stock market went way high because of the very low interest rates. But the stock market investors, I think, were not doing a good job of what we call discounting the future revenue stream from that stock at what would be an average interest rate. They took the 1% interest rate that was prevailing and applied that to the stock and said, oh, stocks are worth a fortune when interest rates are 1%. Well, everyone knew that interest rates couldn't stay at 1%, right? So people should have been evaluating stock with interest rates at 4.5% or 5%. If they had, then stocks wouldn't have ridden up as high, and they wouldn't have as far to come down when interest rates now go up to 4.5 or 5. But one of the things that is shaking the stock market, and all of the professional investors are saying will happen, is the stock market's going to go down when interest rates go up. Well, they should have known that interest rates were going to go up, and they should have built that into the valuation of stocks, which is only proof that the stock market is volatile, because the people who invest in it and the people who buy these stock aren't very good at evaluating the future and discounting what's going to happen.
So the people who bought the stocks when the Dow Jones was at 7,500, and they bought in while it was low like that, have made all of these gains. The people who bought the stock when the Dow Jones was 3,000
made more.
Yeah, but they're going to fall further.
Oh, you mean about 30,000?
30,000, yeah.
Yes.
30,000.
Yes, there's more air under them than there is above them. So, you know, I thought that at 18,000, and now I'm saying that at 36,000. So what does Sandy know? Because at 18, at 18, I was wrong. But the more air there is, when you look at historic trends, and when you look at what's called the price-earnings multiple, so a stock price is, if the stock price is 100 and if the stock earns $10 a year, its price earnings multiple is 10, right? It's 10 yeah. times its earnings. So people evaluate the stock price as compared to the earnings level, and the price earnings multiple is a way of evaluating how high the stocks are being priced as compared to other years.
But so, I wasn't asking this to say that Sandy was wrong. I was asking because I've just noticed and witnessed this and was trying to figure out, you know, there's a risk. That's what this.
Well, yeah. But everyone would tell you that if you put your money in the stock market
long
when
run,
your child is born and you put it in your child's name, by the time they're 21, they'll have a lot more money than you put in. And that's been true.
Just leave it.
That's been true for the longest period of time. And it's still probably true, even if you put money in at $36,000 and you put it into an index fund that's going to reflect the general stock market, 21 years from now, it's going to be worth more. You know, that would be history's lesson. But if you need to take it out in 6 years or 7 years, you might get burnt. So, you know, that's why the stock market's risky. Not that in the long run it's risky, but in the period between now and then, it can go up and down, and that presents a risk.
All right, we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams is still here. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, I wanted to, we keep getting caught up in that socialism. I believe in capitalism. I don't believe in socialism. That's communism. That's communism. We don't hear as much anymore about communism, but we do hear a lot about socialism. And I don't think the American people, many of the American people, a large percentage, even understand when they hear and they talk about the socialism aspect of it. And so this article is talking about the differences between how American and Chinese governments regulate capitalism. Regulating capitalism, is that?
Well, first of all, I mean, Adam Smith thought that there needed to be regulation of capitalism. You need to regulate the marketplace to make sure that the market is a fair market that has competition in it, that will operate so that the businesses don't take control.
So who regulates that? Government?
Well, marketplaces kind of regulate themselves as long as there are enough competitors. But then it's the antitrust laws. That's what antitrust law is about, is regulating marketplaces.
Well, and governments write that, though.
Sure, and then that's right. It's government regulation. You know, first of all, there's lots of things that are nominally socialism. Sewers. You know, in fact, Milwaukee used to be called a city of sewer socialists because we were one of the first cities to take public money and build sewers and build out the water and sewer infrastructure. And that was viewed as socialism. No one views today it's socialism if sewers and water facilities are owned by the government. People believe that's what governments do. Bridges, you know, until cars were invented, there were a lot of toll roads and things. Roads could be private or they could be public, but no one today believes that the construction of highways is a reflection of socialism. Military is a common good that's paid for by the government. It's a socialized form of defense so that you and I don't have to have a neighborhood militia. So we have a government army. And that's a form of socialism. So there's lots of things we simply accept. And then the question is, how far do we reach in the terms of the definition of what's a public good? Medicine, you know, the access by each of our citizens to medical care, that in many places is viewed as a government duty to provide medical care to the citizenry. And is that viewed as socialism in the cities? Well, the private medical industry here call that socialized medicine, but many places undoubtedly wouldn't tie that to some some ideological theory of government. It's just that people need medicine. We need medical care. We've got to give it to them. So education was, you know, the sewer socialists in the around 1900, the American public decided that everyone in America ought to be entitled to education. So we have public schools. Is that socialism? Well, it is as much as sewers. It is as much as bridges. It is as much as the rest of it. So I think it's just a question of where we draw the line. But the marketplace isn't suggested even by the Adam Smith basic economists that the marketplace will provide us with everything we need or want, or nor should it, nor would it. And so we need to evaluate how best to support a vibrant marketplace. And my assertion is that some of these things that other countries have set up, like education and healthcare and childcare, are not socialism. It's the provision by government of the basic needs and wants of citizens so that a marketplace that is free and open can exist. Now, what's happening in China and the United States, to me, is an interesting morph between a country, China, that started communist with all state-owned things, and the United States, which has always felt like it was the basis for true private ownership of most everything, and they're beginning to morph together in particularly the way we try to deal with large capitalism and the startup of new industries. The Chinese government has morphed away from basic communism to being a place where most businesses, particularly large businesses, are invested in by the government. The government's acting more or less like a private equity fund. And these businesses are left pretty much to their own devices by the Chinese government to succeed or not succeed. And so they do have access to investment capital on a basis that's different than the investment capital of the United States, although lots of companies in China are now being invested in directly by American investors. Alibaba, all kinds of very big Chinese businesses are bought and sold by American investors who have a private interest and ownership in them. And the government has as well provided, the Chinese government has provided capital to them so that they can start up and or thrive. And what's happening in the United States? Well, we've long had tax subsidies to various businesses and industries. We're now developing things like a $55 billion fund to support silicon chip manufacturing in the country. What's that? That's a subsidy. So the United States government has realized that in order to compete effectively against a very effective economic process like what is ongoing in China, we have to create something more hybridized than what we've had in terms of the way our free market economy is operated.
But the difference, and correct me if I'm wrong, the difference between what you just said with China and our country is that China's private equity is being used to help not only develop the businesses, but also to benefit the citizens.
Well, they
in America, it's there to benefit the business, but what about the beneficiary? Benefiting the citizens.
Well, we've had this theory, which maybe got verbalized by Reagan, that when we benefit
trickle down.
And, you know, the president of General Motors who recited during the Eisenhower administration that what's good for General Motors
is good for America.
Good for America. We have that view that what's good for – and, you know, and there's some truth to that. But the Chinese have more strings attached to their investment that relates to things that might relate directly to the number of people to be employed and other things that would have an effect on the Chinese local economies. And they also have an impact on the standards that are employed by the companies that they invest in. But really, I mean, one of the successes in the Chinese economy has been the capacity of the Chinese communist government to use self-restraint and to allow these companies to operate quite independently from them to become quite successful.
So do you think it's China is looking at it from that perspective because they had so many people they had to lift up in this development of its country as opposed to our country, which, you know, didn't have to bring people from the lowest ebb?
Sure. I mean, China was much closer to third world, and we were clearly first world and have been for a long time. So they had a different perspective on things. They, you know, a communist country, the theology of, you know, the ideology of communism is supposed to be premised on all the people, right? And sharing equally.
Right.
So, you know, there probably was a different... And the Confucian society there is different than ours, so their cultural values are different than ours in many respects. And so, you know, that's one of the problems with us trying to export our thinking entirely to a culture that is so different than ours with a different value set than ours. But China's just been, you know, it's been, and this is not me saying that China is a better place than America, but China has been very, very successful, and its hybridized version of capitalism suggests that our version of capitalism is maybe not optimal, and that it needs to be rethought somewhat. And clearly, that is happening. You know, deciding that we should inject $55 billion into the silicon industry from the government is a big change in thinking.
You know, Sandy, we this competition that is never going away between our nation and China, and it's in my conversations with people, again, I've repeated this, I'm going to repeat it again. Earl, how many times are you and Sandy going to keep talking about China? And I keep saying to people, you don't have to, you know, you can ignore China all you want to. You know, I go and look and find things that I think are important to discuss, and I can't help it. Everything seems to be pointing, you know, as if and the guy says, well, if you love China so much, why don't you go and live there? Yeah. I said, it's not a matter of us loving China.
Yeah.
We're trying to get people to understand in this country. Well, China is not what we used to see on the old movies of the 40s and the 30s with some guy, you know.
Charlie Chan.
Yeah.
Well, you know, China is very important to us. In fact, if you read the Wall Street Journal and the financial news lately, they're very preoccupied with whether China is going into recession, because China is so important in the world economy that a recession, it used to be if, you know, when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world gets a cold. When China sneezes, the rest of the world gets a cold. And so, you know, people are very worried about what's happening to the Chinese economy, this lockdown in Shanghai and the problems they're having with COVID and the way they're dealing with COVID is worrisome to the rest of the world, because what it's going to do to both the supply chain but also the demand chain. If the demand in China drops off because of a recession in China, the rest of the world gets a cold.
Who do we have on the line, Sam?
Andy from Beaver Dam.
Hey, Andy, how you doing, man? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hi, Sandy, how does the stealing of our technology and trade secrets by the Chinese, how does that blend into this whole
hatred.
Way the Chinese...
Well, you know, there undoubtedly has been commercial espionage by the Chinese, just like there is commercial espionage within the United States and there is with other countries. But a lot of what's happened with China is the result of some things that are totally legal, not illegal. Number one, China has not signed the International Patent Treaty, so they aren't subject to the restrictions of our patents. They're free to make things that are patented in the United States and sell them within China. They can't sell them internationally, but they're free to use that technology and sell it in China because they're not subject to the restrictions of patents, number one. Number two, many of the companies in the United States that went over to China and built factories knowingly gave up access to their technology to China. It was a condition of doing business there. Now, people can say, well, that was an unreasonable condition of doing business, and we were having our gun held to our head, but no.
We didn't have to go.
We didn't have to go, and the fact was that China was such an enchanting place for these companies to locate, to access the cheap labor, and most of these companies and probably the American enterprise generally underestimated the extent to which China could take advantage of the technology so completely and so effectively. So, you know, I think we point at it and say, well, they cheated and got it so quickly, but actually most of what they got can be attributed to legal conduct that in which we gave it to them, where they had access to it by right.
We've got to go to a break. Thank you, Andy. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. The Buster Show. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. That's Fridays. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, I want to go back to what Andy from, was it Andy from?
Yeah. Beaver Dam.
Said. And he kind of represents a thought of many Americans.
Oh, it's a widespread view. And there's no question that China burst onto the scene with a great deal of effective technology. And, you know, most recently they beat everyone to the punch with the 5G technology for telecommunications. And, you know, I think the problem is that the United States, the establishment manufacturers who went over to China to access the cheap labor there and the trained cheap labor and the convenience that China offered in terms of the capacity to put together manufacturing enterprises very quickly, underestimated the fact that they would actually be able to take it on to themselves to develop their own. You know, we had gone to Mexico, and Mexico didn't do that. And I don't think we expected that China would be able to organize itself so effectively to take advantage of the things that we were giving them access to. But the operative term there is giving them access. The condition that everyone went to China with, they knew that every plant that was built there belonged to the Chinese government and did not belong to them. They were leasing it for a period of time. They were the equipment they put into it was going to belong to the Chinese. Technology was being given up knowingly in that process. And so, you know, China leapfrogged forward. We should have, you know, China's an ancient civilization. It has an education system that's very highly regarded, a very trained, huge population, a very disciplined population, a population that has a high work ethic. So should it have been a surprise? No. Was it a surprise? Absolutely. There's no question that by the year 2015, the people who had gone to China in 1990 were astounded at where China was coming and getting to at that point. You know, in the year 2010 and 2015, did we view China as an enemy? No, we viewed it as this country that we were intertwined with that was a commercial miracle that was helping our businesses achieve commercial miracles. You know, now we're labeling it as an enemy, and I think it's clear that most of the impetus for that enemy status is the fact that China is unbelievably commercially successful and is threatening to remove the United States from its totally dominant role in the world economically. Does that require us to label them an enemy? I don't think so. But it appears to be something that we're ready and willing to do, which is to say China's an economic powerhouse that we need to be scared of and worried about, and we need to accuse them of becoming a powerhouse illegally because they stole our technology.
You know, Sandy, you make me think about, again, when, you know, the American businesses started heading over to China, and a company where I was working wound up going over there, and we didn't know. We thought that our companies themselves were building the factories, and that they belonged, the factories belonged to the companies of our country. And so if all of those companies that were built, the brick and mortar,
yeah,
belong to the Chinese and we rented,
yeah,
the facilities. Yeah. And then I heard you say that even all of the equipment that were in these, that all belonged to China too?
Well, that was going to belong to China when we left. Yeah. If it was attached to the ground and a fixture there, yep, it was theirs.
So if what we hear now is you constantly hear America first and this eventual give and take, and safe to say, not trust in China. In many instances, I don't know if the businesses have lost faith and trust in China, or if it's just a whole political thing. But you know, you hear people talking about, well, bring our businesses back here. Is any of that feasible? Is any of that possible?
Well, let's look at it. Tesla is a very new company, right?
Right.
Yeah, so one of the fallouts of this lockdown in Shanghai is we all come to realize that Tesla has a huge plant in China. you know, that the, where they manufacture right. Teslas, and those Teslas are both for consumption in China and elsewhere, and that's going on with lots of companies. And have they lost faith in China? No, Tesla, obviously Elon Musk hadn't lost faith. That factory was built in the last several years. So I think people who do business with China, I mean, everybody who does business in another country has to deal with the cultural differences of that country, and they have to deal with the problem of a home court advantage, right?
Right.
So they have a lawsuit in China. The Americans suing in China probably don't stand as good a chance in that court as the Chinese chance stand, but maybe there's that same sort of home court advantage in the United States. There is in most countries.
So we're intertwined now. With China, and it's almost an impossibility to separate out.
Well, I hope so, because you know the way we're headed with this Ukraine conflict is the potential balkanization of the world into a couple of different opposing interests and international interests. One would be the Russian and potentially the Russian, Chinese, Indian kind of block as one block, and then the rest with the United States and the rest. And that's not a very comforting kind of a breakdown in the world, and it doesn't portend well for the world economy going forward, and it doesn't portend well for international relations or international peace. So,
and it probably hurts us more than them, since there are more Chinese to trade with than there are Americans.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could say, well, if it happens that way, it's going to arrest the rate of development of those countries. But I don't think so. I think that China has proven that it is a fundamentally important economic entity in the world economy.
All right. Sandy, I can't believe it, but we're at the end. And we are for another week. It's been great as always. Prediction for Sunday.
Oh God. Well, I'm obviously since I've never bailed out on the Bucks, I'm going to predict that the Bucks win. But you know, it's going to be interesting because the Celtics are a way different team than the Bulls. So
yeah. So I'm really excited about Sunday's game. Probably been a long time since I've been that excited about a basketball game, but. I'm really excited about this one, and I like you, the Bucks prospects, but I can't. Can I go back?
You can. You can withdraw.
Yeah.
Your bailout. I knew at the time that that wasn't like you, Earl. You're not a quitter.
No, man. I remember giving up on the Bucks after the second game with the Bulls.
Yeah.
And because that wasn't the real Bucks. I see. But the real Bucks are back?
Well, let me just say, that Buck team better not reappear.
Well, the Celtics can make that Buck team reappear.
So remind me, how many more? So the Celtics, then they'd have to win two more series to actually win the championship.
Yes.
The Celtics, the next series takes them on to the finals.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, even let's say they defeat the Celtics, Philadelphia has another series, and if you defeat the Celtics and then have to play again, I mean, they've got a long road to hoe.
And there's no question Embiid and the 76ers have been a bit of a thorn for us.
Yeah, and I watched them last night, and they're tough. All right, we got to go. Sam, have a great weekend. Never mind it's going to be 40 degrees. All right, I'll see you guys on Monday. Be safe. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.